Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content. They may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Skippy sat on a wheelchair, which was pushed into the corner of the hallway, as to not get in the way of the other airmen, who were being carted in and who were in need of medical attention. Since what Skippy was experiencing was uncommon, and there was nothing physically they could do about his condition, he was put on the bottom of the priority list to be seen. The doctors assumed that Skippy was simply faking his condition, or was just getting himself so upset that he fried his brain, something that they had diagnosed a handful of airmen with in the past. The men all heard a story of a guy by the name of Rocky Steve when they first arrived in Thurlow. Rocky Steve flew with the 531st Squadron and was a top turret gunner and flight engineer like Willie was. However, during his eighth mission, Rocky Steve lost the ability to hear. There was nothing wrong with him, but he insisted that he couldn't hear. The doctors and nurses simply didn't believe him, so, to test their assumptions, the brass took him off flight status and put him on letter duty for 15 days, with the hopes that he would snap out of it. That was in July of 1943. Rocky Steve was still doing letter duty when Skimpy and the Men of the Bull arrived in Thurlow a month ago. He was labeled by some of the officers and upper brass as a coward, but the men he served with, and a majority of the enlisted men who had seen combat and felt its effects, knew that Rocky Steve was no coward. Skippy hoped that whatever was causing his blindness would soon end, for the only thing more terrifying than being in the hospital was to be in the hospital with only the ability to hear the ghastly sounds of hell. A man screaming at the top of his lungs echoed down the halls and past the lonely blind airman, who was using all the energy left in his body to not cry. Another airman would soon be carted by him, asking the nurse to please kill him, for he did not want to go home to his wife and kids, having to empty his bowels into a pouch for the rest of his life. The man's voice soon dissipated as he was carted into one of the surgical rooms. After a moment of eerie silence, the doors of the hallway flew open again, and being brought in on a stretcher was another airman who had just returned from the mission. The airman kept asking the nurse if he was going to die, to which the nurse continued to say, "You're going to be fine, you're going to be fine." Then Skippy heard another door open, and the man's cries for God's mercy and healing became muffled and almost silent as the door was closed. Then Skippy heard a male nurse say to one of the other nurses, "Give him 2 shots of morphine, there's no point in doing surgery." "What, we're not even going to try?" asked one nurse. "No, there's no point." "But I just told him he was going to be okay," said the female nurse. "Well, you shouldn't have done that. False hope is worse than anything being shot at these guys. Look, there's nothing that the doctor can do. He's going to lose both of his legs. He's going to have to get all those splinters out of his body. And those 3 that are in his chest are way too close to his heart. I mean, Christ, he's lucky he's still alive right now for how much blood he's lost. It would take Dr. French at least 2 hours to perform the surgery, and he'll die by then." The female nurse then, based on her breathing and speech, began crying and asked, "But what am I supposed to do?" "Give him 2 shots of morphine. Numb him up. It's about the most merciful thing we can do at this point," the male nurse said, patting the female nurse on what Skimpy guessed was her shoulder. The male nurse then seemed to leave the hallway, and Skimpy then heard the doors of the room containing the crying man open. Skippy could now hear the wounded airman crying out once more in pain and agony. For the next half an hour, he heard the airman's cries and moans soften, and finally, nothing, a sign that he had passed. The nurse appeared back in the hallway, and based on her sniffling, it only confirmed Skippy's assumption about the fate of the airman. Then the sounds of another female nurse, a much older nurse, appeared in the hallway, and asked the younger nurse if playing with his hair helped. The young female nurse, with the temptation of crying hidden behind her voice, replied that it did to calm him, but it only made her feel more upset. The older nurse explained that for every person that they couldn't save, there was always 10 that they could save, and that's what she should be focusing on. Skimpy listened to the entire conversation as he unknowingly stared at the wall right next to him. The hospitable younger nurse then took a deep breath, and soon another airman was wheeled in. The medic, who was helping to push him in, told the two female nurses that the airman had been injured in his leg and needed the metal fragment extracted. They had given him the blood that he had lost, and he was for the moment stable. The nurses then carted the man over to the surgical section of the hallway, where he would be next in line to go under the table and go under the scalpel. What Skimpy didn't realize was, the airman who they just brought in was Mills. Days later, April 1st, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0950. Willie, Tommy, Beans, and Pally were standing behind their hut in the grass that separated their hut from the airfield, which was 300 yards or so away. Pally and Beans were throwing a baseball back and forth, since Pally had brought a ball and two gloves with him. Tommy and Willie both simply watched. "Do you think Skimpy and Mills are going to come back all messed up?" Pally asked. "What do you mean?" questioned Tommy. "I mean, will they still be Skimpy and Mills, or are they just going to be all nuts in the head?" "I know you guys know what I'm talking about," Pally replied. "I think you think too much. Of course they'll come back fine," Willie said. "Yeah, but you guys told me all about that Rob guy. He was all, you know, I know you guys know. Rob was like that whenever we met him, okay? He's no different," Willie fired. No, Willie, he's got a good point. There was something messed up about him, even more than before. He was quiet before, but now he's all Mr. Thousand Yard Stare," Tommy commented. "Yes, that's it. It was his stare," Pally pointed out. Willie scoffed at Pally's point. "What, you think they're really both going to be fine?" Tommy asked Willie. "I think you kids always think the worst of things. For fuck's sake, we experienced and lived through Berlin. Now that was a snafu, if I've ever seen a snafu. And we pulled through it on our first mission. Skimpy and Mills are going to be fine." "Would it make you feel better if we visited him today?" Beans asked Pally. "It would. I just don't want to go alone," Pally commented. "See, I agree. Why don't we all go to the hospital and surprise Mills and Skimpy? I mean, it's been enough days now," Tommy added, looking at Willie. Willie didn't say anything further. He just took a moment of pause, looked up, took a deep breath, and gave in by saying, "All right, I'll go see him too." "Perfect," Pally said, throwing the ball back to Beans. The boss was sitting inside of Hill House in Texas's hut. He was drinking some of Hill House in Texas's special brew of cowboy coffee. The boss was sitting in one of the chairs at the card table, smoking a cigarette, which was nearly burned down to the fingers. He had smoked nearly a whole pack of cigarettes since he had gotten up. His eyes were sunken in, his posture defeated, breathing quick. He hadn't gotten over the death of Shelby, and honestly, he still hadn't gotten over the loss of Al, Bill Roush, Clyde Duke, Cobb, Robert Dearborn, and now Shelby. Each loss took something from the boss, and he was now wondering if he made a mistake by spending more time with Hill House, Texas, and the officers from their crews. Texas was sitting at a chair to the boss's right, facing the back of the hut. He was telling his co-pilot, Wolf Miller, about a trip he and his wife Lilia had taken to Tennessee before Texas went overseas. Texas had a larger-than-life persona to him that made him extremely likable. His charisma and his big Texas attitude is what made men like the boss find him such a pleasure to be around. He was loud, talkative, and never dull, something the boss liked very much. Sitting across from Texas, to the boss's left was Nebo, Deuce's bombardier, who asked the boss a question. The boss, being so focused on trying to remember Shelby's co-pilot's name and face, while also looking like he was paying attention to Texas's story, didn't hear Nebo's question. After asking it again, the boss looked over at Nebo and said, "I'm sorry, come again?" "No, it's okay. I just asked, do you and your wife have any kids?" Nebo asked. The boss looked at the young kid's face. He seemed so innocent, vibrant, and blooming, which didn't make any sense. His best friend Cobb was killed less than a week ago. His chances of getting back home to see his darling wife was getting slimmer and slimmer with each passing day. How in the world could he be so goddamn innocent by asking such a stupid, "Are you okay?" Nebo asked the boss. The boss looked off on the side of Nebo's head, took a deep breath, and said, "Yeah, I'm fine, I'm just thinking." Texas had stopped telling the story. He was now staring at the boss, along with Wolf Miller. "Thinking about if you have any kids?" Nebo asked. The boss then remembered what Nebo's question was. He looked over at him and said, "No, we don't have any kids. We want to, though. Lots of them. Get ourselves a big old family of rugrats." "Say, you don't look good there, buddy. You sure you're all right?" Texas asked. "I'm fine, Texas. Thank you for asking," the boss said softly, trying to not sound sarcastic. "No problem," Texas said, not knowing what else to say. Just then, the door of their hut opened, and a corporal entered into the hut and asked for Captain McCormick. Texas affirmed that he was, in fact, the man he was looking for, and then the corporal asked if any of them knew the whereabouts of Lieutenant Backus. The boss looked behind him at the corporal and said, "That's me. How can I help you?" "Corporal Poole would like to see you two men." The boss gave Texas a look of surprise and confusion, and soon, the two men left the hut and followed the corporal back to the offices. Colonel Poole's office was located in the old Thurlow Estates, which used to be the largest house in the area, with 9 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, a horse stable, courtyard, and backyard terrace. The boss marveled at the gray stone structure and always wanted to know what it looked like inside. Upon entering, the boss was baffled at the almost original furniture that belonged to the house long before it was given to the Americans to serve as the personal quarters for Colonel Poole and his top brassmen. The floors were dark oak, the walls were dressed in green wallpaper, and in the middle of the mansion was a brown staircase, which had very fine detail carved into it. Walking up the steps, the boss could feel the thick boards beneath him and could feel the love and devotion its artists had poured into making such a marvelous work of art. Upstairs, the boss and Texas followed the corporal all the way down the long hallway, which had a welcoming and inviting smell to it. The boss only assumed that it was the smell that was left by the previous owners, since it was only in this section of the house, the least trafficked part, and the smell suited the house quite well. Arriving at one of the bedrooms on the right side was Colonel Poole's grand office. He had 2 large English-paned glass windows on the wall behind his desk, which overlooked the area that used to be the original owner's front yard, but now was the location of United States Army Air Force Station 186, or Thurlow Airfield. The corporal introduced the men and proceeded to leave, closing the door behind him. The boss then looked to his right, and standing at attention was Jack, Rosie, and Andy. A very confused and concerned boss stood at attention along with Texas. Colonel Poole, who stood behind his desk, dressed in his formal officer's attire, noticed the look of confusion on the boss's face and said,
"I bet you men are wondering why I brought you in today. Well, I brought you, Captain McCormick, in because, as of 3 days ago, the 530th Squadron Commander was shot down over the target, and the 530th needs a new squadron commander. Honestly,
I know this won't come as a surprise to you, Captain McCormick, but you got yourself a very impressive background and experience. We could use that. I'm told that you used to train men on how to fly a multi-engine aircraft. Is that right? Texas nodded his head and replied, That's correct, sir. Good, good, good. Well, judging by how the other officers see you and view you, and also hearing good things from members of your crew, I could only conclude that you'd be a great fit to lead the 530th Squadron. Colonel Poole then approached Texas with something in his hand. Walking up to Texas, he opened the small case, which revealed two bronze oak leaf pins. Taking the pins out, he took Texas's two silver bar pins off and replaced them with the oak leaves. Pinning them to Texas's collar, he said, It has been brought to my attention that you have not been promoted since you were made an instructor. Now, I spoke to your former CO, and he spoke not only favorably of you, but he said that this promotion is long overdue. So, I hereby promote you, Captain McCormick, or, should I say, Major McCormick. Keep up the good work, son. You're making a lot of people proud. The boss was outraged at Texas's promotion. He liked Texas, and he thought that he was a good pilot, leader, and chief of his crew. But he had done nothing to prove that he was worth being put in charge of an entire squadron. He hadn't led the 530th Squadron or the 300th on a mission. On the other hand, the boss and his crew had led the group, on their third mission no less. He knew that this was all a stunt, because there was no way that HQ would allow himself, a rookie first lieutenant, to lead a squadron when they have a captain, who was formerly a multi-engine flight instructor, to do it. This wasn't about who was capable. This was about who had the highest rank, the most connections, and better people backing them up. It was all a game. Texas saluted Colonel Poole, and before the boss knew it, Colonel Poole arrived in front of him and said, Lieutenant Backus, Captain Dearborn sang your praises when he flew with you a few days ago. He said that you knew how to handle the plane, got along great with his men, expected the most from them, and pushed them to be the best. Now, I'm amazed that he was aware enough to gather all of that in one sortie, but nonetheless, you made an impression on him, and that says a lot, because Captain Dearborn was one hell of a man and one hell of a leader. Shame he wasn't the squadron commander longer, but he's got one hell of a successor, Colonel Poole said, looking over to Texas and giving him a big smile, which sickened the boss. Sorry, I digress, Colonel Poole said, as he went back up to his desk and grabbed four cases and then arrived back at the four men from the bull and continued. And I was made aware that a mistake had been made during the St. Nazaire raid and that a rookie crew of Loda Bull were leading the group. And by the time I found out, you boys were already in the air and gotten the job done. It was one of the best bombing attempts the 300th had had in weeks. Excellent job. Keep it up. And you, Captain Backus, could be expecting big things in your future if you keep it up, Colonel Poole said as he removed the single bar off the boss's collar and replaced it with two silver bars. The boss was stunned as Colonel Poole proceeded to arrive at Jack and presented him with the silver bar to replace his bronze bar, promoting him from second lieutenant to first lieutenant. He then did the same for Andy, promoting him from a second lieutenant to a first lieutenant. Finally, he arrived at Rosie and said, Lieutenant Rosenthal, your bombing reports were impressive. That was a difficult target, yet you bombed the hell out of it. Son, we will have no idea of how many torpedoes will not be fired, or how many soldiers will be saved because shipping will bring them the food, clothing, and equipment needed to get the job done. And you and I will never know the true power and impact that a job well done has on a war effort. But maybe one day, we will see some of that impact and power. I know that you've made many, many people, including your family, proud. Congratulations, Captain Rosenthal. Colonel Poole shook Rosie's hand and saluted each man and proceeded to excuse Major Anthony Texas McCormick, Captain Anthony Boss Backus, First Lieutenant Jack Miller, First Lieutenant Andrew Moreland, and Captain Isaac Rosie Rosenthal to leave the office, and the men with smiles on their faces proceeded to exit the manor. Do you love vintage warbirds? Do you love drinking good coffee? Would you love to be able to help keep warbirds in the sky by just drinking coffee every single morning? Well, believe it or not, you can by going to www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com and signing up for a bag of great tasting fresh roasted coffee. Guys, this is a veteran-owned and operated business that I discovered back in July. And let me tell you something, I drink so much of the stuff that you could say that Snafu runs off of Warbird Coffee Company. These guys partner up with operators and museums, and for every bag of coffee sold, they give back to their partners to help keep the memory of the Greatest Generation alive. They're available for everyone living in the United States and Great Britain. If you want to find out more about who they are and what they do, go to one of their social media pages by just searching up Warbird Coffee Company. And get this, if you use the promo code SNAFU20, again, SNAFU20, you will get 20% off any product that you buy from Warbirds. And if that's not enough, you can get 15% off your first order by visiting and subscribing to their website, www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com. Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them. They're sponsoring us. So I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close. Check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canso 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force from World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. Mills awoke in his hospital bed. His thigh wound was still causing him a great deal of pain. The doctors didn't view his wound bad enough to warrant any more morphine past the first 24 hours during and after the surgery. The doctors pulled an 1-inch-long, 3-centimeter-wide piece of shrapnel from his rectus femoris muscle. The surgeon then said that the femur bone is what saved him from having any further damage. When Mills asked how soon he'd be put on flight status, he was told 4 to 10 weeks, depending on how well he recovered. This simply was ridiculous in Mills' eyes, because he couldn't be away from his crew for that long. He would never forgive himself if something happened to any one of them while he was laid up on a bed of misery. While Mills was somberly laying in his bed, five familiar faces approached him at his bedside. It was Willie, Tommy, Beans, Pally, and Mason Pointers.
Well, hey there, fuckface. Have they cut your legs off yet?
Willie asked, trying to make light of the moment.
Willie, come on,
Pally said, gritting his teeth together.
Yeah, seriously, do you want them to escort us out?
Beans asked, looking genuinely embarrassed.
What? I'm just pulling his leg. Okay. I'm done, I swear. I can tell he's on his last leg.
Willie joked again. I missed you so much, Willie, you big chin son of a bitch, Mills said, cracking a smile. How are you holding up, Mills? Tommy asked.
Well, I'm alive. It's always a good thing, right?
Mills asked, trying to hold off any whining and complaining.
Yeah, after what we went through 3 days ago, it's a miracle any of us are still alive. He said that was one of the worst missions the 300th has flown in months, said Mason.
Is that so? Asked Mills.
Yeah, did you hear about what happened to Skimpy?
Tommy asked.
No.
What happened to Skimpy?
Mills asked, looking concerned.
He lost his eyesight, but he wasn't hit. It was the weirdest fucking thing I've ever seen. I'm surprised you haven't seen him or heard anything, Willie said, looking around the second floor hospital room.
I haven't.
But they may have sent him to a psychiatric hospital if he lost his eyesight but he wasn't hit. That is the oddest thing. Is he all right, though? Mills asked.
Well, we don't know yet. We're trying to find him, but he was scared as hell last time we saw him, Beans commented. Poor kid. First that thing with Emma, now that, Mills said as he began looking up at the ceiling.
Hey, no worries, Mills, she'll be fine. We'll be fine. And you'll be fine.
Did they give you a purple heart? Willie asked, trying to again lighten the mood.
They did. At least I got something.
They wouldn't let me keep the shrapnel fragment, though, Mills said.
You see? Now that's bullshit. They should at least let you keep that, Willie added.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm the one who caught the damn thing. I should be the one to keep it, furthered Mills.
Well, how about this? Why don't we drop by tomorrow morning with a fresh edition of Stars and Stripes? Tommy said.
That would be awesome. Seriously. It would make my day, more than seeing Mr. Chin Man, Mills joked, pointing to Willie.
The men made last comments and jabs before they left Mills' bed and made their way throughout the hospital, trying to find Skimpy.
That night, the boss, Jack, Rosie, and Andy were sitting at the Cock Inn enjoying a night of celebration. Joining them were the men from Hill House's crew and Texas's crew. The boss and his men were sitting at a booth by the fireplace, while Texas and his men were sitting on some leather chairs grouped together by the fireplace. Hill House and his men were sitting at a table behind Texas. Texas kept taking glances at his oak leaf pins on his uniform, using his thumbs to shine them.
I'm telling you guys have to try these on sometime. The moment those oak leaves hit your collar, I don't know, it gets to you,
Texas commented, looking around the room.
Does it make you feel smarter? Benson asked.
No, but it does make you feel like you can get away with a lot more shit, Texas joked.
If you don't use it for that reason, then what's the purpose of getting the damn thing?
Teased Hillhouse.
Say, I'm not the only one here who deserves some glory tonight. Anthony there got himself a pretty good promotion, Texas said, shining a proverbial light on the boss.
Jack was sitting catty-corner from the boss in the booth and saw the glimmer in the boss's eye when people started asking questions about what it was like to be moved to captain status. Rosie, who was sitting across from the boss and next to Jack, was smiling ear to ear. The first thing he did when he got his promotion was he wrote a letter to his mother and father back in New York. Andy, who was sitting next to the boss but across from Jack, sipped on his pint of brown and bitter. Andy had grown up so much since he had gotten hit on the mission to Berlin. He was almost a completely different person. He was more quiet now, rarely spoke up, and genuinely seemed to fit in with men like Jim Appleton and the group of the so-called professors that often hung out at the Officers Club or at the Red Lion Inn in Haverhill. Jack enjoyed the time that he had with his crewmen, for this was the first time they had all sat together for a long time. The rift between Jack and the boss was by no means over, but for that evening, with the good news, it was put on hold. Once the feelings of grandeur and glory faded away, Jack knew that the boss would go back to disliking him and being hostile with him and towards him. Tonight, Jack's group of friends, that is, Parnell and Brolin's crews, were out in Haverhill pub-hopping. What Jack found odd was, men like Texas and the boss couldn't get enough of their promotion and what the future held for them. The boss was holding on to that promise that Colonel Poole gave to him by saying that if he kept up the good work that he'd had big things planned for him. Jack could already tell that whatever that meant, the boss had heard it like a pregnant woman being told that her due date was coming up. If the boss had a specific date of when these big things were going to happen, he would have written it down on a calendar and would have counted down the days and even hours leading up to it. But on the other hand, when Jack told men like Parnell, O'Brien, Brolin, and Coca about the promotion and why he was going to be joining them tonight, they were indifferent to the good news. When Jack asked Brolin and O'Brien if they had ever been promoted, Brolin scoffed at the question and replied with, "I pray to God they don't give me one. Hell, I would avoid that like the goddamn plague." Jack didn't have enough time to ask Brolin what he meant by his comment, but he wished he had. Why have men like Brolin, Bernhausen, Leslie, and the others not been given promotions, even though they've flown more missions than the boss, Texas, and Hillhouse combined? Why was it that Leslie and his crew, who were just a handful of missions away from completing their tour of duty, not leading the 530th Squadron? How come Leslie never got a promotion in the 4 months he'd been in England? Was there something he was missing? Was there something he wasn't getting? Later that night, the boss, Jack, Rosie, and Andy were heading back to their huts along with Hill House and his three officers. You know, I love nights like this. Just us walking, smoking a cigarette or two. Nice, warmish night. Good day. Good drinks. You know, just a perfect, lovely day. Hill House adored. I agree. It's been a good day. Lord knows we needed it, the boss commented. Yeah, it's been a rough last week. Gotta be honest. When we came over to England, I thought the things I was hearing from guys coming back from after finishing their tours, you know, about what it was like in the last year, I thought it was all just, you know, what do you say it is, Benson began to say, but couldn't seem to find the right word. Over the top, Luther guessed. Yeah, over the top. You know how guys often do things after a rough game or a hard day at work? It always seems worse when you're in it, but when you look at it from a 1,000-foot view, it wasn't as bad, Benson explained. Wait, so you're saying that when I told my wife I had a hard day at work, that it wasn't nearly as bad as I made it seem it was? Hill House joked, which got a few chuckles from the men. Yeah. Now, we can't afford to let our wives know about that, but us guys, we get it, Benson finished. Oh, I know what you're saying. I didn't believe it either. Frankly, I don't know how any of us really could, because if you think about it, the newspapers back home were shouting the Air Corps' praises, especially over in Europe. We heard 1,000 of those war bond specials about how heroic it was to go and give it to the Huns and how we were basically doing a bang-up job over here. And then there was that whole thing with the Memphis Belle. So when we heard how much of a snafu this war really was, once we were in the military, none of us had any reason to believe them, Nebo noted. And did you guys notice how vets never talk about their experiences to kids like they should? Jack asked. The men stopped walking for a moment and pondered Jack's question. Jack, what do you mean? Didn't your dad tell you all about his experiences in the Great War? And what about that old Civil War man they used to go and talk to? The boss asked. Yeah, they did, but they never talked about the carnage of it. You know, the hell of it, the snafu of it, the terror of it, Jack clarified. But that's the thing, is how could they? I mean, would you be able to? Hill House asked. Not to mention, you wouldn't believe them even if they had, the boss commented. I know, I've always wondered how I'm going to tell anyone back home about the things I've seen and witnessed, Rosie softly butted in. The group then began walking when the boss was getting unsettled about the conversation. I know, what I'm saying is, I think being open and honest about the things we're experiencing in war is what's best for future generations so that they don't have this glorified view of war, Jack said. That's foolish, Jack. Humans are always going to have a glorified view of war, the boss fired. Yeah, I mean, think about this, Jack, Hill House began to say as he began walking next to Jack and threw his arm around his neck and pulled him in close. War is simply compelling storytelling. It's a subject that makes the eyes of both boys and old men widen. And if you think deeper, it's a conflict that's always helped humans to evolve more quickly. I mean, think about the thing we fly in every single mission. 40 years ago, man for the first time successfully flew through the air. And within half a lifetime, we're flying these four-engine beasts with enough gasoline to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool so that we can drop bomb loads of sizes that people 5 years ago couldn't even fathom on places that soldiers may never step foot on. I mean, who knows what planes might look like 20, 30, 40 years from now? All because of war. War is simply a necessary evil. As much as we hate it, as much as it pains us, as much as it does damage to society and to the human race, it is essentially a necessary evil. He makes a good point, Jack, Andy fired. Jack thought for a moment, and then out of one last ditch attempt to prove his point, he spoke up by asking, do you gentlemen know the author Wilfred Owens? Oh, come on, Jack.
Not another one of your American lit lessons. Okay, look, we get it. You read books. The boss fired. Hey now. That's uncalled for. No need to be a jackass. Go on, Jack. What about this Owen guy? Because odds are none of us have ever even heard of him. Hillhouse said, much to the boss's disgust and frustration. Well, I didn't know either, until my father gave me this book the day I left for basic. I didn't read it until about a week ago, which is what got me thinking about this whole war thing, Jack said. Okay, let's hear it, Andy said. I'm all ears, Jack, Benson said, shooting the boss a deadly glance. Jack then pulled a piece of paper out from his pocket and began reading what he had written down. Okay, so it goes like this. I try writing it down as best I could, but just start, Jack. There's no need for an introduction, the boss jabbed, raising his voice. Enough! Don't listen to him, Jack. Okay, you wrote it down. It starts with, Jack tried to ignore what the boss had just said and did so by holding up the piece of paper to the moonlight in order for him to read it. Bent double, like old baggers under sacks. Knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through the sludge. Till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest we began to trudge. Men marched to sleep. Many had lost their boots. But we limped on, bloodshot, all went lame, all blind. Drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots. What's this about? Benson asked. You shut it, it's about the war, obviously, Luther thundered. Jack continued. Of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling, and floundering like a man in fire. Dim, even through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dream you could only pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the whites in his eyes withering in his face hanging like a devil sick of sin. If you could only hear at every jolt the blood come gargling out from his froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as the cancer, bitter as the cud, of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. What passing bells for these whose die is cattle, only the monstrous anger of the guns. Only the stuttering rifle's rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers, nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells, and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all, not in the hands of boys but in their eyes, shall shine the holy glimmer of goodbyes. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children, ardent for a desperate glory, the old lie. Dulce et decorum est, pro patria moe. What the hell does that mean? Benson asked. Well, this is a rough translation, but what it means is, it is sweet and proper to die for the motherland, Jack said. That was impressive. How many times did you read that? Hillhouse asked. I don't know, a few dozen times or so. I'm sure I messed up in some parts because, you know, can only see so much from the moon, but I don't know, it just got me thinking. My father obviously owned this book and he had it in his possession for years. I definitely have seen the cover before in his library. It makes me think. I wonder why he gave it to me just now and why he didn't tell me about this earlier. The boss spoke up by saying, that's a great story and all, Jack, but listen, okay? We've all made our points. War is a necessary evil, okay? It's a thing that gets human beings to evolve, like he said, okay? So I don't know why we're talking about this anymore. I don't know why you're trying to play all philosopher. Okay, seriously, is it just in the booze and you talking? What is your problem? Hillhouse yelled over to the boss. The men stopped walking just in front of the shower facility. The boss's feet rolled over the gravel as he turned to look at Hillhouse and said, why don't you stay out of it? No, you've been an ass ever since we left the Cock and Balls Inn. Now, spill, what is your problem with him? Hillhouse said, pointing to Jack. The boss clenched his jaw, extended his neck, and replied, He's an immature child.
Wait, I'm sorry. What?
Jack began to yell, with Rosie and Benson now starting to hold back Jack.
Yeah, I said it. You got promoted today, and not once did I hear you ever say a thank you.
The boss fired back.
A thank you? Jack yelled. Yeah, you got promoted today by the big guy, and you never once thanked me. Thank you? Thank you for what?
Come on, Jack. Why else do you think you got promoted?
Because I'm good at what I do.
No, bullshit. You're a mediocre pilot at best. You barely scored a 90% on your written test.
So the fuck what? Who cares about a stupid test score? I've been holding my own. I've been doing what you've asked by taking more charge. You certainly had no problem letting me fly the crew all the way back to base while you were too shell-shocked from losing your two buddies. Don't you dare bring Shelby or Dearborn into this, Jack, you son of a bitch.
The boss thundered as he was getting physically heated, and soon, Nebo, Andy, and Luther had to hold on to the boss back from attacking Jack.
Well, let me ask you this, boss. I'm dying to know. Did you cry because Shelby and all of them got killed? Or did you cry because now you have to find a new group of people to worship you?
At this, the boss barreled through the three men holding him back, and he lunged at Jack. The boss piled on top of Jack, Rosie, and Benson, and began throwing punch after punch in the direction of Jack, although some of his hits landed on Rosie and Benson. Soon, Hillhouse grabbed the boss by his collar and threw him off. As the boss tried to get up, Benson, Rosie, and now Jack, with a bloody nose, huddled over top of him.
Come at me again, you son of a bitch! I dare you!
Jack yelled. Just as Rosie and Benson started to make their next attack at the boss, that's when Hillhouse called out,
Hey! Let them fight it out. They both need this.
Rosie and Benson both stepped back, and soon, the boss stood back up and began closing in on Jack. Jack began walking backwards, but not before he backed into a wall next to the door that led into the showers. Jack quickly entered into the showers, hoping to gain some time and possibly take some advantage on his opponent. The boss quickly entered, and once he did, he flipped on a light that ran down the length of a white cinder block hallway with a corrugated tin roof. Seeing Jack running down the hallway, he then turned into the showers. The boss then began running after him, with his adrenaline and anger flowing through his veins. Once the boss turned the corner, he saw Jack standing stunned in the middle of the room. Once the boss saw what Jack was staring at, he froze up too. They were looking at the corpse of a dead airman who was dangling from a belt which was wrapped around his neck.
Hey guys, this is Aaron from Canto 34 Studios. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. I hope you're enjoying this episode. Real quick, I wanted to give you guys something that's near and dear to my heart, kind of let you in. One, I can't believe it's been 17 episodes and I haven't talked about this yet. I haven't made an announcement or even talked about it, and I apologize for doing so. But I also want to talk about it because of what is occurring in today's episode. So, we have a lot of veterans who listen to this podcast. A handful of them have reached out to me. It's been great. I've made a lot of good, great connections. I've talked to a lot of you listening. And I thank you guys so much for all of the time that you've given me and sharing your story. And thank you for the encouraging words. However, with that knowledge of there being so many veterans listening to this, I personally, as a non-veteran, I have the highest level of respect for you. Because PTSD is something that it's no joke. You have to be a very strong person, both mentally, spiritually, physically, to be able to wrestle every day with something like that. I have a father who struggles with PTSD from combat. I just want to say, if you're a veteran and you are struggling with what you've done, what you've seen, what you have experienced in combat, you're not alone. And you are extremely loved. You're so incredibly loved. And there's a lot of people in this world who, if something were to happen to you, our lives would be forever negatively affected by your loss. And I bring this up because in the time that you've listened to this episode, a veteran somewhere has taken his own life. In fact, every year in the great United States of America, 6,000 veterans die by their own hand every single year. That's extremely sad. And it breaks my heart to hear things like that. If you're listening to this podcast and you're struggling with PTSD, please seek help. If you feel like there's no hope for you, if you feel like if you're gotten to the point where you're so tired of fighting that beast, you just want to give up, please don't give up. There's plenty of places for you to reach out to and find help. Places like the Lone Survivor Foundation. The phone number for that is 832-581-3592. There's also the Lone Survivor website by going to lonesurvivorfoundation.org. There's also maketheconnection.net. There's a great, great, great site called Project 2.0. There are so many great, great places for you to reach out to and find help. I'll put all of those links down in the show notes. If you're struggling personally or you know someone who is struggling personally, please see to it that you give them those links and you share with them where they can get help. I love you. So many other people love you. Don't stop fighting. Find the help. If you're going through hell, as Winston Churchill said, don't stop. Keep going. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. A medic cut the belt from a rafter and released the airman's body and laid him onto the cold concrete floor. Later, it would be discovered that the airman was First Lieutenant Jeffrey Adler, a navigator from the 529 Squadron, whose best friend was in the plane that detonated over Frankfurt when its bomb bay took a direct hit from a flak shell. The man had died within 10 minutes before Jack and the boss discovered him. The horrific and gruesome discovery had stunned both Jack and the boss into giving a momentary truce to their fight. The men had returned to their huts and gotten themselves cleaned up and dressed for bed. The boss was the first one to crawl into his bed, and soon, a very somber Andy and Rosie got into their beds. Jack had decided he wanted to have one more smoke before calling it a night, so he grabbed his pack of cigarettes and a lighter and proceeded to walk outside. Once outside, Jack looked up at the cloudy night sky. He wondered what he could have done wrong to deserve so much hatred from the boss. He didn't think he was that bad of a pilot and a leader. He thought that he held his own, and Hill House could testify for that. But why couldn't the boss just see that? As Jack pondered this, Brolin and his crew arrived at the hut. As Brolin approached Jack standing outside, he said,
"What's going on, Louie?"
"Nothing much. Just found an airman who hung himself," replied Jack.
"Well, that's not nothing much. Holy shit, who was it?"
Brolin asked.
"I don't know. They just said he was an officer from the 529 Squadron," Jack replied.
"Oh, fuck me, that's the second guy that's done that since we've been here," Coca said.
After hearing this, Jack looked puzzled and said, "Wait, what?"
"Yeah, shortly before you got here, we were out with Griffith, and we found the sergeant from the 531st Squadron who blew his own brains out. We weren't the first one to find him, but we did stumble across his body. It was fucking nasty,"
explained Coca.
"Well, other than that, how was the celebration?"
O'Brien asked.
"It was fine. Say, Brolin, can I ask you a question?"
asked Jack as he saw Brolin about to enter into the hut.
"Sure,"
Brolin said, letting go of the handle and closing the door again.
When I asked you if you had been promoted since you got here, you said that you prayed to God that you would never get promoted and that you would avoid it like the plague. What did you mean by that?"
Brolin paused for a moment, as he was shocked by the question. He looked up and gathered his thoughts and then looked back down at Jack and said,
"It's easy. I just don't want the responsibility. Neither do people like Leslie, Ronnie, or really anyone else. Have you not learned yet? Sheila asked. Learned what? Jack asked. Jesus Christ, Louis. See, this is why you being around that boss of yours and men like him is a bad idea, O'Brien said as he stepped closer to Jack. Can you guys just tell me already? What do I need to learn? Jack asked. Louis, okay. Let me spell it out for you like this. The military simply values results over lives. They have to. They have a war to win. And they have plenty of glory-starved young kids like us to fight the war for them. I mean, the men who started this shit, we're just pawns on a large chessboard. So when you're up there, you have to remember that the five-star generals who sent us on that mission, they don't give a shit if you lose 30 men on the bomb run and will lose 30 more because there's bad cloud cover and you have to go around to another target or go around on the bomb run all over again. Because if you lose 30 men, as long as the bombs hit their mark, they'll give you 30 more glory-starved kids for your troubles. Because to them, there's an objective. And we're trained and told to stop at nothing to see to it that that objective is completed. The problem is, though, months later, when you bring back good report after good report, and they give you one of those oak leaves or something shiny to pin to your uniform, you'll be faced with the question, how many men had to die for you to get that shiny thing on your uniform? If you value protecting your men and getting them through this thing alive as best you can, then there are going to be some times that you'll have to put their lives over the fate of the mission. And that just simply doesn't get you promotions. O'Brien then added, yeah, Griffith learned that the hard way. Honestly, if you think about it, he didn't become a Hellraiser until after he was promoted. It was like he was trying to get demoted. Coca and Sheila agreed. Jack had to process what Brolin O'Brien had just said to him, and he tried to wrap his head around it. After a few seconds, Jack then said, but it hasn't come to that yet. For you, no. But your pilot? He's got his eye on the next rank, the next promotion, the next big thing. And there will come a time where you will know in your head that what he's doing is the best thing for the mission. But in your gut, you'll know that the boys in your crew will die that day so that your boss gets an attaboy from the brass. I pray that you have enough piss and vinegar in you to stop it, but I doubt it. No offense, I just doubt it, Brolin countered. I'm sorry, I just don't see how you're right, said Jack. Maybe I'm not, but go ahead. Ask people like Leslie, Bernhausen, or Ronnie. In fact, I challenge you to ask any officer in the 300th that's flown more than 10 missions if they give a flying fuck about getting their next promotion. You'll find out quickly that there's a very few amount of them that have flown more than 10 missions who say that a promotion means anything to them. Most of the time, they're going to say that they don't give two squirts of piss over it. Brolin finished.
Yeah, kid. We've seen a lot more of this shit than you have, okay? So you can trust us. But trust me, you don't want to chase after medals and accolades. They will always promise you the world, but they will never fucking deliver. You can trust me on that, Coca added.
Jack stood in silence while he processed this information. The next morning, Jack was sitting with Parnell and his men at the officers' mess hall. The breakfast that morning was pork sausage, toast, and beans. As he ate, Jack was listening to Parnell tell stories about his brother.
Okay, all right. Let me set the stage for you, okay? So, my brother James at the time is 17 and I'm 12. My pops was working an extra shift at the shoe factory and wasn't coming home until morning, and Ma was visiting her sister in Canton. My sister Dottie, who was 15 at the time, snuck out of the house to stay with her friend, so it's just me and Jimmy at the house. Well, his two buddies from the old block and my best friend Doyle all come over, and we had this bright idea to raid my parents' liquor cellarette, right? Who doesn't? Well, we go in this thing, and it is stocked. We're talking stocked with these bottles of whiskey, vodka, gin, you name it, it's in there. Now, mind you, Prohibition had just ended less than 2 years previous, so these bottles, they were treasured by my parents like they were the fucking Holy Grail. So, with all that being said, we are looking at these bottles of alcohol, and we picked this bottle of gin because men drink gin, and we wanted to be men. What better way to feel like men than drink some gin? And we each agreed to take, like, two shots from this bottle. We thought because the bottle was already open and because there was some already taken out of the bottle, nobody would notice if there was a couple shots worth taking out of it. Well, after those two shots, we are so blurred and slurred that we just aren't thinking clearly. And my brother proceeds to take the bottle and pour more for himself and more for his buddies. Before we know what's going on, my brother and his two friends are now boxing each other in the living room. And me and Doyle are so just amazed by what's going on that we take the bottle, we perch ourselves on the couch, we drink, and we watch them fight. Well, by the time we realized how much we drank, the bottle was almost gone. My brother panics, and we get this idea to add water to the bottle and put it back in the cellarette until my brother could get a buddy of his to go buy a new bottle and replace it. It seemed foolproof. So the next morning, Pops comes home and is so tired he walks right past the living room, doesn't see us passed out in there. And by the way, the room was so messed up, it looked like a goddamn bull ran through it. But he walks right past it, goes right up to bed. We wake up hours later, my sister comes fumbling in and is freaking out about the house. So we clean up everything and we completely forget about the bottle of gin, which was now 80% water. And we had stored it all away in our drunken stupor, so it wasn't sitting out or anything, so we completely forgot about it. 3 fucking weeks later, it's the day before Easter, my pops has his buddies over at the house. He offers them a drink, but not just any drink. Of course, he has to offer them a drink from the finest bottle of gin in his possession, and it's the bottle of gin that we were drinking 3 weeks previous. Now, all the guys there are thrilled to take a taste of this gin. Now, what's funny is my father hates gin, but his buddies don't know that, and he acts like he loves it. So, imagine he's standing there, he hates gin, but he pours himself a glass, and he pours them each a glass of this gin. And the whole time he's doing it, he's talking it up. He's saying, this is the nectar of the gods, that this is the greatest thing that exists right now in Brockton. Every guy from the factory is going to be coming over to his house to have a taste of this stuff. It took him weeks to be able to afford it. Just keeps going on and on and on. The entire time this is going on, me and James are in the other room listening to this, and we realize that we never replaced the freaking bottle of gin. So we start panicking. Like, we have no idea what to do. So then my father's buddies, who he invited over just to try this gin that he's so proud to own, they all take a big, huge swig of it, and Pops looks right at them and he asks them, "Smooth, isn't it?" Parnell's story erupted the group at the table into laughter, and that's when Grant asks, "And they're thinking, this shit tastes like water." Right. They all get real quiet, and my Pops goes to take a drink, and the next thing I knew, I woke up 20 years old. He beat me so good I blacked out. "What, did he hit you over the head?" asked the stunned Nick. "No, dick for brains, I was joking. He did beat us good, though. In front of his buddies, too. It was horrible. Me and James, we had to give up all of our paper route money and all of our grass cutting money for the entire year just to replace it. Then he told our mom about it, and we got beat a second, third, and fourth time. Worst of it all was, we had to tell our parish priest about it, and we had to be put on altar duty for a whole year." That's great. "I can't believe I've never heard the story before," Adam responded. "I can't believe I've never told it. James got me in all kinds of shit like that. I ever told you about the time we..." Parnell began to say, but was cut off when Leslie and the four men from his crew stormed into the mess hall, with Leslie shouting,
"Well, they fucked us. They have fucked us."
Jack and Parnell and the others were all startled at this, and they turned around and began asking what the yelling was about.
Leslie walked towards the table and proceeded to yell loudly enough that the entire room could hear him.
They raised the goddamn missions from 25 to 30.
Wait, what? Asked Parnell. Men all over the mess hall arose with concern. Leslie continued.
Yep. Sons of bitches over there at the 8th Air Force headquarters think that 25 missions isn't enough since the boys are actually making it to the end of their fucking tour. So they raise it from fucking 25 to 30. Goddamn assholes. Who the fuck comes up with this shit?
Eris, Moose, and Roebuck looked livid and even emotional over the news. Soon, men all gathered around Leslie and his men, offering them whatever kind of comfort they could, even though they too felt angered.
This is just fucking bullshit. We were so close to being done. I can't believe this, Eris added.
Leslie was angry almost to the point of tears. He continued saying, They can't do this. They can't. We're not going to make it. We barely made it this far. We're done.
Jack stood in shock, for he felt hopeless as well. 25 missions seemed forever away and felt like an impossible thing to achieve. Now, 30 missions seemed suicidal.
As he gave comfort to his buddies, whose mental well-being was already hanging on by a thread, he wrestled with the reality that the chances of him ever seeing Marlene or his family ever again was now slowly dwindling right before his very eyes.
Thank you for listening to episode 17 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of Obama crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies of Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 18 of Snafu, I Got One.